So there are challenges to producing this framework on the web. So what do I mean by the web? Well, particularly, I mean JavaScript. And as everyone knows, JavaScript has issues, especially for beginner programming. The error messages in JavaScript are not particularly helpful. There is also a lack of tail calls, which concern a functional programmer. Maybe this is not such a concern for beginner programmers, because their programs typically don't do much recursion, especially the functional event handlers will probably not be. Yes.
I'm confused. Your school students, are they going to be writing in JavaScript or in Scheme?
They're going to be writing in Scheme.
So why the error message in JavaScript an issue? Why are we talking about that?
Well, we want to make sure that we have to manage error messages for in the environment. We can't expose JavaScript's error messages.
Okay, you're going to talk about the relationship between JavaScript and Scheme later on?
Yeah, in fact, the heart of my proposal is with the difficulties in doing this on top of JavaScript. So because there are no tail calls, we can't do deep recursion, but that might not be such a problem for beginner programs. There are actually more serious issues in building this on the web. And in order to introduce, and the issue is a bit subtle, so I'm going to introduce it with an example. This is part of a curriculum that tries to encourage algebra. And so let's take an example where we have two images and we want to glue them together, sort of image arithmetic. The beginner student should be able to write something like this. They should say, I want to create an image, I have another image, and I want to overlap them together, produce one more image. And one could think that the translation to JavaScript would look something like this. Basically a transliteration of the Scheme code.
So why are you translating to JavaScript as opposed to writing a Scheme interpreter in JavaScript?
Getting to that.
Okay.
So the translation seems pretty straightforward, right?
But again, the students are not doing this translation.
No.
You're doing this translation.
I am.
Okay.
So just to make it very clear, students are writing in a simplified beginner student language, and my system translates that so it runs on the web. So does anyone have any problems with this code? JavaScript actually does. So the problem is that all the image APIs in JavaScript are asynchronous. They have to account for network latency. And in particular, at this point, we want to be able to tell JavaScript, wait until the images are loaded. If you try to manipulate the images too early before the images are loaded, the browser will throw an exception. In the best case, in the worst case, the browser will actually crash. And I've been able to crash Firefox a few times by trying to work with these incompletely loaded images. So we found that that functional programs on top of JavaScript need to be able to block. So as a caveat, there actually is a blocking form in JavaScript 1.7. Unfortunately, I can't use that because JavaScript 1.7 isn't supported by many of the browsers I care about, like IE or Chrome.
How about HTML5?
What about HTML5?
Is that relevant here?
No. Insofar as JavaScript is the language that I'm running on top of, I need to use features that are supported by the majority of browsers.
But we'll come back later. But I thought that HTML5 is the future of browsers, and wonder would that make more sense as a target environment.
But I need a programming platform to run on top of, and HTML5 only presents a presentation layer. It doesn't provide the dynamics that I would need.
Okay.
There is also a context assumption or a context problem that a lot of the people who are going to be using the system Danny's building do not run on modern browsers with modern upgrades. We really do have to be able to support IE6.
May I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
All of this is completely irrelevant, even HTML5. The relevant thing is that it's only a presentation platform. It's basically glorified HTML. It has no dynamics.
Got it. Thank you.
So one might think that the source of asynchronicity here is somewhat accidental. You know, we could imagine that maybe we could preload the images up front before starting the program, in which case we don't have to worry about network latency and the program works. Well, unfortunately, the asynchronicity of JavaScript is actually at a much deeper level, more fundamental, and that's what this next example will illustrate. So say, for example, I need to state that since we don't have a blocking form available to us, the actual program that does the right thing, that is to block after and wait until the images are loaded, looks something like this. We start off by starting the load of the first image, and we have to set up an onload handler, which defines what happens after the image is loaded. So control is given back to the browser. Browser later on calls after image loaded, and then we do repeat that. And this needs to be handled by the language. We can't expect we must not expose this to the programmer. So here's the second example that I'd like to present. Let's say that we had that game and it finished its animation. We'd like to present another dialogue that says, "Do you want to play again?" And if the user presses yes, well, then we should start the game again. That in itself is another event loop. That's a Big Bang. So we would like to do this. So there's actually a problem with this, and it has to do with the architecture of Big Bang. Mechanically, in order to receive Big Bang is the event loop starter,
which as constructed by Thalysin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So mechanically, in order for Big Bang to function on the web, it needs to give up control to the web browser. And I need to emphasize the fact that we need to abandon control back to the browser. So in our diagram where we had the user, the operating system, and the callback, control actually, that user is actually the browser. Yeah?
Dang, I'm sorry, but this is a small thing, but you've got to make sure your lines all go, you're going backward in time from some of the brown to the yellow. Okay, I assume time is going downwards here.
Time is going downwards, yes.
Okay, you're going backwards in time in from some of your brown to your yellow.
That's an open office artifact.
Oh dear, I'm sorry.
Open office deserve what they get.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Danny. In the big picture, but this is the second picture that I've seen, and I have to call you on it when we get to this, if you're going to use the picture again. So just... for future reference, go, please.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
My apologies. So,
That's a PhD.
if he can, yeah, there you go.
So, in the architecture of JavaScript, in order to receive events, you have to actively give control back to the browser, get it back into an idle state. That means there aren't any pending computations allowed on the control stack. Control flow needs to be given back to the browser. And so in this example that I would like to write, I'd like to be able to say, if user chooses yes, start the game again, otherwise quit the game. And user chooses yes, uses this Big Bang. Well, the act of using the Big Bang in order for Big Bang to work, I need to eliminate all the pending computation, which means that the start again and quit game actually aren't allowed to be there. And so, ideally, I would like the system to be able to say, "Okay, I know I need to do this bit of computation."
You're going to discard the continuation.
Yes, exactly. I need to discard
when executing Big Bang, and
I need
start game and quit game have to be alternate continuations.
I need to reinstate the continuation after the choice has finally been made in the game. So. We want to have a functional Big Bang. I should be able to use Big Bang without restriction as an expression anywhere in my program. In order to allow examples like modal dialogues to work. So this cements the idea that functional programming needs to, on JavaScript needs to be able to abandon and restore control context. And this sounds very familiar to functional programmers. What I'm really talking about is continuations. So because JavaScript doesn't provide these operators, I need to build them on top of JavaScript myself. These are the operations that I need. The last two, abort and prompt, should be fairly familiar if I call them throw and try catch. Those are essentially that's what abort and prompt are. Save and restore take the current control context and swirls them away somewhere. And later on you can restore to reinstate that in place. Basically, it's like if you're in a video game and you press the save button
you can also then select continue in order to restart the game. And so here's how we're going to apply these operations to those two examples. For image initialization, I set the on load handler to simply restore the continuation. And then for Big Bang, I do something similar, except throughout the process of the Big Bang, I need to call these functional event handlers. And so I can't have the existing control context just lying there on the stack, so I need to abort the current continuation, set that aside, allow any functional event handlers to run in the dynamic context of the Big Bang, and finally reinstate the original continuation afterwards.
And the stop when, we didn't really talk about that in the...
Stop when is the function that tells when the event loop should be terminated. It's basically a world to Boolean function.
So like when your UFO is hit bottom.
Yeah. Yes.
So how difficult technically is it or was it to implement continuations on top of JavaScript?
I'm going to be getting into that actually. It's
is that something you've completed already or going to do?
I've completed an initial version. The interpreter that you were asking about, I've actually done that.
Okay.
But it's
this is all coming up in the slides.
Okay.
So, yeah.
But still, so again, in terms of proposal, so can you make clear here what it is you've already done and what it is partly done and what it is you're going to do, because that's kind of important.
Yes, exactly. I'll do.
So
what
you're talking about here is what you've done or.
This is what I need.
Okay.
So I'm talking about what I need, and then I'm going to be talking about what
I've
done
okay.
So far.
Got it. Thank you. That's fine, Dr. Zation.
Okay. So so now that I've talked about what I would need to do, I need to now talk about implementation. And so this is going to take us some sort of a historical road. I initially did the most naive translation from beginner student language to JavaScript. Basically the version that seemed to work fine for regular programs, but occasionally would fail. What I would see images that would not load, browser crashes as I described earlier, and finally realized that this asynchronous image loading problem was showing up. Furthermore, in my initial prototype, Big Bang could only be used as the top level. I couldn't use it in this modally. I couldn't use it in expression position. Furthermore, the first prototype dealt with a very simple language. Even though I was working in Racket, which is a laboratory for program experimentation, I couldn't use many of its features. And finally, on some advanced programs, especially those dealing with recursive data structures, I would hit the stack frame limit. The recursion stack limit is actually a larger problem than I made out initially, because very popular web browsers, including Safari, have a limit of about 500 stack frames before it crashes out on you, which is pretty darn low. So what I did next was write an interpreter. And this interpreter explicitly managed the control stack in order to get me the continuation, the control operators that I needed. It uses Racket's production level compiler to get me optimized bytecode, and I wrote an interpreter on top of it in order to execute that bytecode. And this does work, and it's at the heart of Wii Scheme, the online programming environment that I've written. Unfortunately, it's a bit slow. The interpretive overhead makes it uncomfortably slow for programs that use heavy algorithms like Dijkstra's or TFS search, and also for the target platform that I want to deploy these on, like smartphones, it's also prohibitively high. So that's what I've done so far. So this is what I'm proposing to do now, which is to go back to compilation, but do a little bit more smartly. Have the code explicitly manage control stack as well. So the idea is that I'm going to have Racket source. I'm going to use the Racket compiler again to get me bytecode. I'm going to then further compile that bytecode into JavaScript and then have a managed evaluation for that. So for example, let's take a very simple expression.
So this is a standard JIT, basically, a native compilation. Are you doing it just in time, or are you doing it as a
I'm doing it all ahead of time.
All ahead of time.
Yeah.
So interesting to come back to is whether JIT would be appropriate here or not.
Yes. I was thinking of that initially, but the simpler strategy for me seemed to be do the compilation of all up front. So here's an example run. We have some code. And I know this code looks deliberately simple. It's meant so that we can actually understand the flow. So I run through the Rapid compiler, and it gives me this. It's basically a very simplified data form. I then process that through my compiler to produce intermediate language. And then finally translate that and to JavaScript.
What's the difference between top right and bottom left?
So the top right includes is the bytecode. It allows for complex operations. The right hand the code on the bottom left only allows primitive operations. Primitive operations, simple branching, assignment. So it's a much more restricted language than the top right. And although it, for this example, it's not demonstrating it very well. I'm getting a lot of I'm getting a lot out of reusing the Rapid compiler. The Rapid compiler gives me a lot of optimizations, including code folding, loop unrolling, constant folding. And as I said earlier, the simple intermediate language is only allowed to do very simple things like assignment, primitive operation, stack manipulation, go-tos.
Now you also mentioned previously you wanted the macros and the modules.
Oh yes, the other thing that the Rapid compiler is giving me is macro expansion, which is nice because it gives us the possibility of switching out different language front ends, one that looks more like Pascal or Basic or Python, if I wanted to, and the Rapid compiler would deal with translating that into an intermediate form that I can then process. Yes?
So it looks like the last step is very, very direct, because anything that's complicated, you've got predefined subroutines, like the environment management subroutines for. So this is really just almost interpreting.
It's almost trivial, except for that last part about go-to, right?
Right, sure.
Go-tos. JavaScript doesn't have go-tos. So I need to do something about that. So, and go-tos are fundamental. I need to be able to jump from, I need to be able to do procedure call return. I need to do procedural linkage, and that requires a go-to. Furthermore, I would like to be able to do pointer arithmetic on go-to labels. The reason for that is because Rapid provides multiple value return. You're allowed to return multiple values, and you don't want to pollute your code to do that check at every step, and there's a clever way to eliminate most of those runtime checks if you have two return addresses rather than one. And the second return address needs to be dynamically computed. So the way we solve this is to appeal to Lambda. So although JavaScript doesn't have go-to, it has functions, and essentially function call is like a go-to, so why not treat it that way? So each basic block in the intermediate language becomes translated into a function, and I can support limited pointer arithmetic. If I know up front what addresses I want to do arithmetic on, I can attach attributes to the functions that I'm going to be doing arithmetic on. Concretely, if I have code that looks something like that in the intermediate language, I can translate it to that, where each basic block becomes a function, and since I'm doing arithmetic on after call single, I can specify the what the predecessor block is that way. And so if I get a return address dynamically, I can then do the predecessor. I can look up at the predecessor attribute to get at the previous block.
But if you're implementing go-to via function call, don't you need tail recursion in the language?
I do, and that's an additional thing. So,
okay.
In order to offset the problem of unbounded recursion due to using function call as go-to, I need a trampoline. So what I do is I set up a top level trampoline that and maintain a count of how many go-to jumps I've done. After a certain point, I'll jump off and then restart the trampoline. So there's actually a very nice, they're very, very nice artifact of this, which is it allows me to implement interrupts. Every so often I can, instead of immediately restarting the trampoline, I can give control back to the browser, leave the control stack as it is. And if the user has pressed anything like a break button or some sort of other interrupt, when I come back into the trampoline, I can detect that and then act appropriately. And that allows me to implement break in a trivial way. It also allows the web browser to remain responsive. And most browsers still have only one thread of execution in JavaScript. And so if you want to do multitasking, you have to do it cooperatively. And so this scheme works surprisingly well for that. One other thing is that because I'm explicitly managing the control stack, and I can attach information to each control stack frame, and so in so provide reasonable stack traces. And so the related work in this area, there are several evaluators on the web, including those in like TryRuby, TryHaskell, and IDE1. These are all server-side evaluators. The idea is you take your program, send it over to the server. Server completely evaluates it and then returns the textual result to the user. I find that unsuitable for the application that I care about, which is being able to run client-side, very active. Yes.
So in terms of the server client thing, the only thing you mentioned so far was the delayed downloading of images, which I'm familiar with
yeah.
in the web. Is there anything else here that?
Oh yeah, the JavaScript is full of asynchronicity.
Like what?
Script loading, resource loading, contacting other web services. Because of network.
But are
latency.
Those things used in your Scheme programs?
We've been working on prototypes to hook up to do mashups with other services like Google Maps and Delicious. We thought that there would be compelling examples to have student programs interact with these external services, because the web is, being on the web means you can contact all these other services.
So I guess I don't have a good idea of the scope of what you're doing. You keep bringing up new things here. So if you're so you showed us sort of, I've taught LibNovel too, as you know,
mm-hmm.
and so I know your basic graphics programs, and just even to do that, you have the problem which you went through very clearly.
Yes.
But now you're saying that other stuff on the web you might want to do, and so I just have this kind of open-ended feeling for, are there other problems, are you, in your thesis, are there other such problems you're promising to solve? You obviously are promising to solve the graphics loading problem. Do you have a list of other ones that you're going to solve? I mean,
well, more generally, for any JavaScript asynchronous JavaScript API, I'm proposing to add to be able to adapt those APIs to blocking to ones that work in the.
So you're saying you can write any program in Scheme that you could write in JavaScript. On the browser, is that your definition of success?
More that I expect to be able to adapt any asynchronous JavaScript API to this environment, and provide a functional interface to that.
And for your thesis, that's a promise for the future. People could keep adding things to JavaScript and so on. So, what is the termination condition for your thesis?
Well, as part of this, I'm also adding in a foreign function interface, so that way people can modularly hook into other JavaScript services without having to contact me. So I think I'd be satisfied if I had a general mechanism for adapting asynchronous JavaScript APIs, as well as a foreign function interface to make that extension possible without hacking into the internals.
Okay, we'll come back to that later.
By the way, in terms of structure, how is this defense structured? You're talking for what,
another
like?
Another 5 or 6 minutes? Mm-hmm. Then we have time for questions from the whole room, then the non-faculty leave, we have a private discussion with Danny, then Danny gets kicked out, and the faculty get to
chat.
Chat.
All done before 11, right?
All done before 11.
Okay.
So I talked about why, are we done with, okay. So we talked about server-side evaluators, and on the flip side are the client-side evaluators, including mine. We steam Hot Ruby and OBrowser, our existing work that do the evaluation either through interpretation or compilation. Unfortunately, none of these support the control operators I need to present a functional event-driven programming environment. So the expected contributions of this work is a web-based evaluator for functional event-driven world programs. A web-based programming environment, which I haven't talked about very much, but I have shown some screenshots. It's a simplified Docker scheme-like environment that allows students to write programs and run them interactively. It's actually being used in Bootstrap and has been field-tested by dozens of middle school students. Also proposing a tool chain for phone programming. Again, I haven't really talked much about the phone, but I can deploy these programs on the web browsers that run on phones and hook into the specific phone functionality of the phone. Phones provide features like the accelerometer and other sensors, and I can tie that very cleanly into the functional event-driven world model. And as a minor contribution, in order to get at some of the more interesting features of the cell phone, such as being able to send phone calls or SMS messages, there's a small extension to World that allows for functional effects, being able to do side effects in a functional manner.
May I?
Yeah.
Ask one question about the
back up again,
yeah, do that up.
Functional effects. In terms of your picture where you have the three columns, one being the user or the browser, and one being the OS, and one being the string of callbacks,
yeah.
When you say functional effects, you're really saying that you're storing the state in the middle column and not the right-hand column.
That's right.
Okay.
No, actually, more clear. Here, let me show you one of the slides that I cut out of this.
Mm-hmm.
So earlier, the way that world works is when you
yep.
receive an event, you get that.
Yep.
This is going to be my extension, which is to add an additional hook for each event type. You can specify a world to effect handler, and if an effect is a opaque value, it's inert, but it represents a side effect that you would like to happen. For example, a play sound object,
mm-hmm.
or send message object. Yes.
Danny, are effects stored or done?
They're applied. They're done.
Okay. So then, when Joshua, I believe that was Joshua, asked you a question: where is this functional effect stored? The right answer should be.
They're discharged immediately.
They're consumed.
They're consumed immediately. The functional effect value gets sent back to the.
But it's
event loop, and then the event loop executes that.
If you think about where the state is stored, things that are in the current world value and will be delivered to the next callback.
Yes.
That state is stored in the yellow
yes.
column there.
Yeah, that's the world is stored. Yeah.
That's what I was asking. And then, of course, the effect is really kind of delivered to the yellow column.
Yeah.
And the yellow column
then
consumes
it
by doing what needs to be done.
Yeah, and then after that it's gone.
And so really that's another value that's delivered back to the yellow column when the right-hand callback activity is completing.
Yes. Yes.
So you started off, Chuck here, Danny, talking about the problems about error messages and debugging, and I'm wondering, now that you've come around, in this implementation, have you solved the problem of weird JavaScript error messages coming up to the programmer and the related problem of source level debugging? How have you insulated the student programmer from all of this JavaScript?
So one thing that I do is the primitive operators that the students use are all guarded. So anything to do with arithmetic, those type checks on the operands, make sure that they're numbers. And if they're not, then you produce a sensible error message.
Before it goes to JavaScript.
Yeah, before it goes to JavaScript.
But, you know, so for example, if you wanted to, can you support all the features of the Racket debugging environment in this implementation, all the error messages, everything?
Fundamentally, I should be able to because I'm implementing the full continuation marks architecture that the Racket debugging depends on. I haven't implemented all of the necessary primitives to be able to pull in that implementation directly from Racket, though.
So is that part, of, again, the scope of your thesis? This is a contract. Is that part of the scope of your thesis is to support all of the error messages and source level debugging in Racket in this implementation?
I think that would be an enormous effort. I'm not.
Why would it be an enormous effort? I mean, if you have the right hookup, all that stuff's there. You just have to present the same API to it.
Yes.
Naively, I would think. I haven't thought through. You're the expert here.
So there are about 1,000 or so Racket primitives that would need to be implemented to provide that support. I've only been able to code up 100 or 200 as of this point. And
I'm confused. So why do you have to recode every primitive? I thought the compiler translates to the intermediate language, and then you have a set of routines for managing the stack and the continuations and so on, which are very, very fundamental. But you don't have to recode plus, or you don't have to recode, concatenate. You don't have to recode everything. The compiler does that for you.
The compiler still generates code that refers to its own set of primitives, including creating thread cells, semaphores, things that I haven't had the need to primitives that I have. Yes. Yes.
And then you get all of those primitives. So I think you're feeling you're making a distinction here, and that may be causing a little confusion.
Yes, there are a core set of primitive operators that are assumed to exist already from the compiler's standpoint. So it will generate intermediate code that refers to those primitives. And
those are the only ones you need to implement.
And those are the ones I need to implement.
And that's a fairly small set, isn't it?
It's been surprisingly difficult to implement all several of them.
Andy, the question is, what's the size of that set, not whether it's depressing, etc.?
The size is in the thousands. It's about 1,500.
Why? What kind of sensibly designed programming language should have thousands of primitives? Why can't we chuck out a little bit here?
Want to help me out? What did he tell me? You, it doesn't
say
matter.
Say that again.
It's not about me. Go ahead.
Well, the Racket runtime is dealing with providing a lot of services for things like resource management. I don't know what else to say besides that there are that many primitives.
But Racket has plenty of sub. But what I would like to hear is that you're going to take some pedagogically oriented sub language, which is certainly part of the concept of Racket, and for that sub language, which is appropriate for your students, that you are going to make a complete good debugging environment. That's what I would like to hear.
I would like to do that.
Anyway. Barron's question, right? Affirmatively.
Yeah, yes, yes. If I limit myself to just beginner student language, I should be able to do that.
Do that, and Misha would do that. So basically, would it be, in terms of the source debugging, could you support all...
I don't actually believe you, by the way.
All right. So the question is, for the usability for these students, would you have all of the appropriate scheme level error messages and highlighting and all the stuff that we know, for example, is really important for students? Can you support all of those? I'm not saying you have to literally run the Racket editor on the cell phone, but support all those key things that, you know, indicate where in the source code the error is and good error messages, and really so they couldn't tell that, so no JavaScript ever, you know, shows itself up through.
I should be able to produce error messages with source locations and present them in an editor that does the appropriate highlighting.
Okay. And is that going to be part of, again, we discussed whether that's part of the scope of your thesis or not.
That definitely is.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why don't we come back to that when we
get
into the four faculty?
Absolutely.
Only, we'll check in on that.
That was my last question.
Other questions? Ken?
So one question I had, other companies such as Adobe Flash has the Flash plugin, Oracle has the Java plugin. Why did you take a JavaScript approach rather than a browser plugin approach?
Ubiquiti.
Can you please repeat the question?
So Ken was asking why not work with something like Flash or Java, use plugins basically. And the reason is ubiquity. I want to be able to run this on pretty much any standard vanilla web browser. And that means I shouldn't use any plugins.
Is Java
including
French?
Ones with fairly weak performance, because a lot of the middle school kids are using these in environments where the overheads of things like Flash means they're just not available.
Is JavaScript kind of a more interesting language than the Flash language, for instance?
Certainly been interesting to work with.
Challenging.
Yeah,
I see. That's a
huge resource.
But I find it to be expressive enough. So,
anybody else have questions?
So, Danny, so you have essentially two user-facing interfaces. You've got WeScheme, and you've got the Mobi set of utilities.
Yes.
So, is the browser add-on paradigm just completely unavailable on the phone, or is it? So I guess I'm wondering what the substantive differences between WeScheme and Mobi are.
So in the case of Mobi, because I'm trying to access cell phone specific behavior, there is a very thin middleware layer that I'm using on top of the existing web browser, basically a plugin to get me some cell phone specific features, such as the accelerometer. There are some features that aren't exposed to the JavaScript web browser on those platforms. So in that case, yeah, I do use a plugin there. But because I'm building the package, I have responsibility for creating that.
So the difference is on the phone, you have some extra stuff that you have to look at and extra stuff that you have to provide. It's not that the core approach is any different.
That middleware layer is pretty trivial, which is why I didn't want to emphasize it in this presentation.
Does Mobi generate application that you can deliver on the App Store?
What's the
delivery model? Is it still something that runs in the browser of the phone?
It still runs in a dedicated browser instance on the phone. Yes.
And that is that different from the things that people deploy on the App Store?
Because the App Store programs may not use the web browser, but some other more low-level canvas. The presentation layer, HTML5, is becoming increasingly powerful enough that it's getting harder to distinguish.
Distribution mechanism is different. You can distribute it through a website, not through, I mean, it's platform independent. There's the Android App Store, and there's the iPhone App Store, and Palm's trying to start one too, and so on. And
as well as Amazon.
Right. So it's not, nothing to do with the App Store sort of model.
It's also getting a bit off topic.
Yeah.
So
a little bit.
A little bit, but All right, so unless any of the students have questions, I guess we'll ask you guys to excuse yourselves and leave Danny to our devices.
Thank you, Danny.
Thank you for coming.
Can you just bring the cookies
so this
back,
is the committee,
please?
The four of us?
Yes. Believe me, Tim, we're not going to leave those cookies here for any old random person in the campus center to